Welcome to this podcast from VTI. This edition is called The Balanced Researcher and is based on our booklet written by Hugh Kearns and Maria Gardner of Flinders University in Australia. In it, we look at different strategies to be more effective in your work as a researcher, ways to balance work and other parts of your life, and specific actions that could have a big impact on your life and work. So, you're a researcher. Chances are, then, you're pretty busy. Firstly, there's your research, proposals, ethics, paperwork, meetings, applying for grants, getting grants, then managing the money and the people, writing reports, and that's all before you even get to the actual research. Then there are papers to write, rejection letters to deal with, and conferences to attend. And for most people, research is just one of the things they do. You might teach or tutor, run demonstrations, manage a unit, or even have another completely different job. And that's just work. No matter how much you enjoy your research, it's likely that there are other parts to your life too. You probably have a family or friends. You may have social commitments, and who knows, you may even have some personal interests. It can be hard to fit all of this in. There are so many demands on your time, so much to do. So is it possible to have some sort of balance, or is this just the way it is if you want to be an effective researcher? Well, the good news is that it is possible to keep a sense of balance and be an effective researcher. Over the past 10 years, the authors have run very successful workshops for thousands of researchers, ranging from postgraduate researchers to postdocs and very senior researchers. We talk about their experience of what works and what doesn't in terms of being a successful researcher, and also how to have a life outside of research. In this podcast, we summarise the most useful strategies and provide a range of suggestions that we and researchers we've talked to have found useful in balancing the different demands in our lives. This podcast is a chance for you to think about balance in your life, what you might want to change, and strategies for doing that. But first, a story. Tell me, does the following situation sound familiar?
Right. I'm in good and early, at 8 o'clock, because I want to finish that paper that's been hanging around for ages. But I best just check my emails for 10 minutes, and then I'll get started on the literature review. And there's one here from my co-author asking if my draft is ready. Oh, I'll do that, and on to the next one. A student in my department saying they can't find a particular reference. Ah, what a pain. Why can't they look it up themselves? It'll only take a few minutes, though. I'll just do a quick check on the library electronics journal. Eventually, I'm there, found it, and emailed it off. 9:15. Right, I'll get the rest of these emails cleared. Oh, the glasswork not cleaned in the lab last night. Wasn't me. Astronomical Society bash tonight. No thanks. Now, I was going to check that reference. 10 o'clock already. Time for coffee and a quick chat with colleagues. Right, 10:30. We've got the team meeting in half an hour, and I've got to prepare material for the afternoon seminar. Oh, that meeting goes on, and it's 12:30. Lunch. Oh, feeling a bit sluggish. I'll do a quick few jobs. That'll get me going. 2:30. Sally wants help calibrating her sensometer. I don't need this. I haven't got the time. But it's only fair. She helped me with the statistics for that last paper. Right. Seminar next. Oh, those questions after the seminar put me right behind. Shut down the computer. Then a department head pops in. How was your day? Well, it was busy, thank you, but productive. But hang on, I'm already late for a meeting of the research committee and they're discussing improving publication outcomes. Home. Family things to do, bills to pay, calls to return. And I've still got that paper to write. Maybe I'll go in a bit earlier tomorrow.
Okay, so that might not be you, but lots of people have asked us if we're spying on them. Imagine for a moment a set of scales which represent the balance between different aspects of your work and home life. Are they weighted heavily in favour of certain aspects? The signs of imbalance are well documented.
Increased levels of stress, worry and frustration, fatigue, and associated health problems, loss of interest and motivation, and a feeling of isolation.
Many people imagine balance as a fixed state where everything is in perfect equilibrium. A better image of balance is of a tightrope walker who is in a constant state of slight imbalance but can make small adjustments to accommodate. That's what life is like. There are always unexpected emergencies and opportunities that can knock you out of balance. One woman we worked with was on an international postdoc, working hard all day, then went home to look after family. Because English was her second language, she attended a class to help her with her written English. She was exhausted. We asked what she'd like to do. She told us she wanted an hour a week doing yoga, but she couldn't see how to fit it in. With a little reorganisation and reprioritising, she was able to find the hour. That one thing made a huge difference. So some of the questions you may well ask.
Have you got the balance you want? What would you change? What would your ideal look like?
So in the rest of this podcast, we'll examine the most effective strategies around work-life balance, time management and effectiveness, and express them in a short, practical form that you can put into practice. First, we'll talk about 10 strategies that can help you be more effective in your work and get a sense of balance in your research role. Then we describe 10 strategies that apply to your non-research life.
Number one, make a plan.
Planning isn't that exciting, and when you're feeling overwhelmed, it's probably the last thing you feel like doing or can find time to do. However, if you don't give some thought to what you want to achieve, you're likely to be tossed around by circumstance and become fairly reactive in your choices. Alice from Alice in Wonderland faced this dilemma.
Would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here? That depends a good deal on where you want to get to, said the cat. I don't much care where, said Alice. Then it doesn't matter which way you go, said the cat.
One of the reasons people give for not planning is that things change and often plans don't work out.
Plans are useless, but planning is essential.
A quote from US President Dwight Eisenhower suggests that plans need to be fluid. Then you can change and update them as circumstances change. So if you look ahead to the next year, what are your plans? What would you really like to achieve by the end of the year? By the end of 3 months? By the end of this week? By the end of today? What is the most important thing you need to get done today?
Number two, pick the right things.
Imagine for a moment you're on a plane and hear this announcement.
Good morning, this is your captain speaking. I've got good news and bad news. The good news is we are 500 kilometres ahead of schedule. The bad news, we're going in the completely wrong direction.
It's more important to be doing the right things than doing things right. Sometimes we make the assumption that working hard is enough, but experience tells us that this is not so. For example, spending weeks marking assignments will not get your thesis written. A massive teaching load is not going to help your research career. Sure, these are valuable activities, but you need to think about which tasks and projects deserve the most attention. So look at the tasks on your list. Are they the right things? Of course, some things will be out of your control, but not everything. Are there things on your list that are taking up time but are not really helpful?
Number three, make time for research.
Research may be only one part of your role. You might also be a lecturer or a supervisor or have another job. What often happens then is that research gets squeezed in at the end when all the other seemingly more urgent things are done. You spend the day doing administration, attending meetings, responding to students, and keep telling yourself that you must get down to your research when you find time. Unfortunately, when you do find it, it's usually at the end of the day or late at night when your brain cells are not that creative. What you have to do is make time. This means setting aside specific time in your diary when you will research or write.
In our experience, the most effective time for doing the demanding aspects of research, such as writing or analysis, seems to be early in the day when you're fresh. Think about setting aside 2 hours, say maybe between 9 and 11 a.m., that you dedicate to writing or analysis.
Number four, learn how to say no.
There's a song. Sorry seems to be the hardest word. However, for most people, no seems to be a harder word. It's so easy to commit to things, to take on an extra project, to keep loading yourself up. Eventually, you end up overloaded. For most of us, saying no is not easy. but there are some alternatives. A good one is to learn how not to say yes so readily. When someone asks you to take on a new commitment, you might answer,
"That sounds interesting. Can I get back to you?"
Or,
"I'll just need to check my diary and I'll give you a call back."
This gives you the chance to think about whether you want to take on the task or to come up with an alternative.
"I can't help you with that right now, but if you can wait till tomorrow, I'll give you some time then."
Learning to say no can really help you to become more effective.
Number 5, delegate.
Some people get overwhelmed because they feel they have to do everything themselves. Now, in every job, there are some things that you personally have to do. But in most jobs, there are also parts you can get help with. You might be lucky enough to have staff you can delegate tasks to. If not, there may be others who can provide assistance, for example, students, administrative staff. Is there money available to pay someone to help? There are several reasons why people are reluctant to delegate.
It's faster to do it myself.
Perhaps the first few times, but long term you'll be overloaded.
The other person won't do it as well as I can.
Possibly, but will they do it to sufficient standard?
I like doing it.
Sure, but you've got so many other things to do too. So ask the question, what could you delegate?
Number 6, set realistic standards.
In our experience, researchers and research students tend to be intelligent, high-achieving people. They also often tend to be perfectionists, setting very high standards for themselves. This has pluses and minuses. The pluses are that they produce high quality work and strive to do good research. The minuses are that the high standards can get in the way of producing good work. Perfectionists can be very critical of their own work, leading to a lot of self-doubt and concerns about their ability. Perfectionists, by definition, find it hard to set reasonable standards. So one strategy is to look at the objective evidence. What have you achieved? What has been the reaction to your work so far? Get an objective opinion from someone else.
Number 7, write regularly.
In our experience, many researchers find writing difficult. It's not that they dislike writing, many enjoy it. But firstly, it's hard to find the time, and then there are the anxieties that it raises. Is what I've written good enough? Will it be rejected? Even when they write, many hesitate before submitting. They think, I need to go over it one more time. I need to polish it up a bit. Some writers also suffer from binge writing. This is based on an assumption that you need big blocks of time, for example, 3 days to write. The problem is that 3 free days rarely appear.
We put one postgraduate researcher on a regime of writing for 2 hours, 3 days a week. He achieved more in 6 weeks than he had in the previous 6 months.
So in our experience, the most productive researchers write regularly, even if it is only in small amounts. Research shows that even 30-minute blocks increase writing productivity.
Number 8, don't check your emails first thing in the morning.
Increase your daily productivity by 20% by simply not turning on your computer and getting distracted by checking and responding to emails that could wait. Instead, use the time to plan your day's work or start on a really important piece of work. Then check your email after your morning coffee. Give it a try.
Number 9, use the 3 Ds of paperwork.
Research involves a lot of paperwork. Journals to read, forms to fill out, requests for information and so on. It's likely your desk and your inbox are piled high. Some people cope fine with clutter, but for others, it leads to a lot of stress and lost productivity. Try this strategy for dealing with paperwork and emails. The next time you pick up a piece of paper, imagine it is stuck to your fingers. The only way to get it off your fingers is one of the 3 Ds.
Do it.
If you can do it straight away, then do it and get rid of it.
Diarise it.
If it takes more than a few minutes to do, then put it in your diary and find time when you will do it.
Ditch it.
If you don't want to do it or diarise it, then ditch it. Yes, in the bin.
Number 10, deal with distractions.
Constant distractions such as phone calls, emails, social media feeds or drop-in visitors can lead to feeling a bit out of control. You have plans, but they keep getting waylaid. But there are some things you can do. Don't answer your phone at certain times. Let it go to the answering machine when you're trying to concentrate or writing. Turn off the email bing on your computer and phone so it doesn't pop up and distract you. Disable unnecessary updates from your social media networks and make use of apps that will give you an easy-to-browse digest from several streams. Then look at it after you've achieved the most important thing on your list. Set up consultation times for meetings and student consultations. Close your office door if you have one. Go to a quiet place if you need to do concentrated work. You're listening to a podcast from Vitae. In this next section, we're going to look at the 10 strategies for keeping the non-work part of your life in balance.
Number one, establish boundaries between work and non-work.
It's easy for work to spill over from your normal workday into the rest of your life. If you don't get things done during the day, it's tempting to tell yourself that you can finish it off at home later. You can check your emails from home, search for references and resources, and be in contact with anyone at any time. The problem with this is that you might start off just finishing off some urgent task, but then this grows into responding to emails, trying to get ahead for the next day. Often, because it's quieter at home, you actually get more done. This can lead to a blurring of when you are working and when you're not. A senior academic described her boundaries to us. She decided to work hard during the week, but wherever possible, not to work at the weekends. She didn't check her work emails. She switched off her work mobile and didn't bring paperwork home with her. She reported that her weekends were much more fun, but she was also being more effective at work. She said,
"In the past, I used to procrastinate about things because I knew I'd do them at the weekend. Now I focus on finishing things when I'm at work because I know I'm not going to work at the weekend. It's helped me focus on the important things."
And it's good to be off duty sometimes. That's when you recharge, catch up with family and friends, and attend to other parts of your life. So while there are no definitive rules, it's useful to think about where the balance is for you. Clear boundaries can be helpful. For example, you might decide not to work at home at all. Or if you do work at home, you might specify certain times.
Number two, get a routine.
Routines can be a useful way of ensuring you get round to things that are important to you. For example, you could set one night of the week when you go out with your friends or family. If you leave this to chance, or when you find time, it's less likely to happen. One person we work with instituted Friday Surprise with his young family. This meant that every Friday evening after work, he got to decide what the family would do, go to the movies or have a meal. By having the routine, people didn't double book on Friday, and the fact that it was a family routine meant that it was very likely to happen. The surprise element also made it fun. So ask yourself, do you have routines that have fallen into disuse? Is it worth getting one going again?
Number three, ask your significant others before taking on major commitments.
Often we take on major commitments that impact on our family and friends without really thinking about what it means for them. So when someone suggests that you apply for a new grant that will take a lot of your time, you might mention it to the people close to you. They might comment, "But you said you were overworked already. How are you going to fit this in?" One researcher we know took this to such extremes that people used to ring his partner first to ask if he was available for new commitments. A general practitioner on one of our courses recalled that his spouse told him, "Your work gets the best, your family gets the rest." It's interesting to think that many of us give our best to people we don't know very well, and the people we do care about see us when we're tired and worn out.
Number four, be present.
Sometimes, although your body has left work, your mind is still on the job. Presenteeism, as opposed to absenteeism, is where you are physically there but your attention is somewhere else. You know the feeling. You're there playing Scrabble with your kids and they ask you a question and you've no idea what they said because your mind was back at work. You might be worrying about something you left unfinished or thinking about what's in store for tomorrow. We sometimes tell ourselves that this is going over of things in our heads. Worrying is useful because we might find a solution.
It's important to distinguish between problem solving and worry. Problem solving is a fairly structured process of working out what can be done. Worrying is recycling the same thoughts over and over, and it's a pretty destructive activity.
There are some strategies for reducing worry. If there is something you really need to do, then do it. Call someone to check if there really is a problem. Write down your worries. Debrief with someone. Distract yourself.
Number five, book breaks and holidays.
Often we tell ourselves we must have a break when we find the time, but then the time doesn't come. An alternative is to schedule breaks and holidays well in advance. The break itself is good, but looking forward to it can also be motivating. Even short breaks are helpful. They can help you get perspective on issues and often you return to work feeling more productive. And remember, your laptop needs a break too.
Number 6, delegate, outsource, get help.
Some of us, high achievers and perfectionists in particular, are very reluctant to give up anything. We think we should be able to do it all. We want to perform well at work, then come home and organise a house and garden and spend time with family and friends. The reality is that there is limited time, 168 hours in a week, and heavy commitments in one area of life mean there is less time in other areas. It's sensible to get help where you can. For example, perhaps you can afford to pay a cleaner to come in once a week, get a gardener, use a babysitter occasionally.
Number 7. Exercise, diet and health.
When things are out of balance, it's likely that the last thing you want to do is exercise or examine your health and diet. Yet these things build up our resilience and give you more energy. It's tempting, when you're under pressure from looming deadlines, to work late into the night and sleep less. This might work in the short term, but it becomes counterproductive. You can end up putting in more hours but getting less output.
We worked with one researcher who had a history of health problems. His life seemed to go in a cycle of feeling okay for a while and then having a serious illness where he couldn't work. His solution was to work very hard when he was able to. In fact, he would work so hard he wouldn't get much sleep or exercise or eat very well. And of course, then he would get sick and not be able to work at all, which only made him more determined to work even harder the next time so he could catch up.
So looking after yourself works better if you have a routine. What small changes could you make on a consistent basis?
Number 8, me time.
What do you really enjoy doing? Did you have a passion when you were a child? For example, singing, painting? Did you have some great interest or hobby? Our interests often get squeezed out when work pressure and other demands increase, which is a shame for two reasons. Firstly, you are missing out on something you enjoy. And secondly, these activities restore you and are likely to make you more motivated and productive. What would you do if you had some me time?
Number 9, review your priorities.
To quote John Lennon, life is what happens to you while you're too busy making other plans. And sometimes it's easy to drift into things or get carried along by peers and colleagues. Because everyone else has the latest labour-saving gadget, you get one. And then you have to work harder to pay for it. And it doesn't seem to save you much labour. Many people work really long hours so that they can provide well for their family. But they work so hard that they don't get to spend time with their families. And when you ask the families what they really want, they say to spend more time with mum or dad. Does life reflect your priorities?
Number 10, have fun.
It's tempting to think you'll be happy when you finish this project, when the house is finished, when the next paper gets published, when your thesis is finished, when things settle down. That might happen, but there's no reason why you can't have some fun now too. You might think all this is just common sense, really. It is. But then why don't we do it? One reason is that over a lifetime we develop habits or patterns of behaviour, and some of these are hard to break. And secondly, we sometimes lose a bit of perspective. When you're in the middle of something, for example, writing a paper, it can seem like the most important thing in the world. When we're busy, our thinking can get a bit muddled. So here are some tips to increase the chances of making the changes stick.
1.
Choose something small and achievable. You don't have to climb Everest, but setting achievable goals and achieving them will motivate you to keep at it and probably lead to more changes.
2.
Commit to change. This means doing something like writing it in your diary, telling people about it, or arranging to involve other people. For example, tell your kids that you will pick them up early after school and walk home with them tomorrow. Or join a book group.
3.
Choose something you can do soon. The sooner, the better, ideally in the next few days. For example, call a colleague today to discuss that book chapter that's been hanging over your head. Or tomorrow, hand in that draft of a chapter you've been hanging on to for weeks.
4.
Reward yourself. If you make a change that was difficult, saying no to an opportunity or finishing off a piece of work that has been hanging over your head, then give yourself a reward. The reward might be having a cup of tea or taking a break or even checking your emails. But remember that the reward must come after the task, not before. So will this work for you? If life is going along fine, then keep on doing what you're doing. If you feel a bit out of balance or want to make some changes, it's worthwhile giving one of the strategies a go. Well, that's all we've got time for. If you'd like to read about this topic in PDF form, that's available on the VTI website along with other podcasts and lots of other information specific to researchers, including courses you may wish to attend. We'd also encourage you to have a look at the VTI Research and Development Framework. The framework has been designed specifically for researchers as an inspirational guide to personal development. You might find it a helpful starting point for identifying your strengths, making an action plan for development, structuring conversations with your line manager or supervisor, or articulating evidence of your transferable skills when looking for employment. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.